A lot of prescription painkillers today are highly addictive or have negative side effects. In Wisconsin, authorities are cracking down on prescription painkiller abuse because it's been leading to addiction to heroin.
But scientists are working on new painkillers made out of animal venom that wouldn't have the same side effects as the medications we have now.
Gemma Tarlak is with us now to share the details of this and other science news. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, good. So animal venom, not something I usually think of wanting to be in me, but it, apparently it could be a good pain. So what is it about animal venom that would be good as a painkiller potentially?
Well, I think we need to understand a little bit about how pain works to really get the connection. And basically, pain is when it's your body's way of saying, hey, damage, danger, watch out. And what happens is the cells, they leak a small charge that travels through a pore and then through a channel. This is, I'm really kind of super simplifying things.
Cliff's Notes version, yeah.
Yeah, if you think about it, there's a channel, and that channel carries the charge basically from the area that is experiencing the pain to the brain. And what they're doing is a lot of drugs out there, including the opioids, they work pretty much by disrupting the signals in your brain. And what they're looking at in venom painkillers, or venom-based painkillers, I should say, is because this venom, it works outside the brain, the chemicals in the actual venom from a lot of different animals. And I want to say it's not just any venom. It has to be a neurotoxin venom. So, you know, a lot of snakes, a lot of other animals, they tend to have hemotoxin venoms, and those actually destroy your red blood cells. Those are not good for painkillers, okay? So let's get that clear. But there are a lot of animals, especially spiders, that have these neurotoxins that block. They don't just block the channel that the signal travels to the brain, but they actually turn that switch off. So the signal never gets anywhere near the brain. And because of where they act and how they act, researchers think that they might be able to design drugs based on those same principles that would not be affecting the brain. In other words, the signals would never reach the brain, so there's no need to, pardon the pun, monkey around in the brain to stop the signals.
And I guess the theory here is that this kind of painkiller would not have the potential to be addictive. I guess it would just be in the system for as long as it's there and then exit.
Yeah, that's correct. Again, because it's working in the peripheral nervous system, not in the brain, not in the spinal cord, it is much lower risk. It has a much lower risk of either side effects or tolerance or addiction, which is great.
Is there a notion as to how soon we could see a prescription painkiller made out of animal venom hitting the market?
Well, there's actually one out there already. It's been out there for about a decade. The problem is it can only be administered through a spinal injection.
Ew.
And that's just because a lot of these peptides, these are the short amino acid chains that they're looking at within the venom as the potential source of painkillers. A lot of these peptides, they will just not survive in pill form. If you pop them in a pill and swallow them, they're going to be destroyed by your digestive system. It gets pretty juicy in there, you know. So what they're doing is they're looking at ways to take the peptides and put them in a different structure that we could digest and take a pill. And that, there are several different researchers all over the world working on this. That is a good, I would say, 2 years away, at least, in terms of clinical trials.
You mentioned spider venom. Any other sources?
Oh, yeah, there's centipedes and scorpions. There's even, you know, we hear about those awful red tides, especially off the southeastern coast of the country, that are, you know, killing just a lot of sea life and the poor manatees and everything. But they're actually looking at the red tide, which is caused by an algae. They're looking at the algae as a potential source of painkiller as well. So it's coming from a lot of really interesting places.
Well, speaking of the world of bugs and things like that, scientists are working on robotic bugs. So first of all, these are not robots. These are actually bugs we're talking about. What are we looking at in sort of this bug-robot hybrid?
Yeah, biobots, they're calling them. And you may remember a couple of years ago, there was this big flurry of interest in creating teeny tiny robots based on how bugs act in nature. Well, the researchers doing that realized it is really, really hard. Nature has it figured out way better than we do. So they started looking at taking actual insects, actual cockroaches, and a type of moth called a hawk moth, and taking those actual living creatures and basically hijacking their nervous system so that they could remote control them and get them to do things like investigate tiny areas where, say, after an earthquake, you know, an earthquake victim might be trapped and get a little robotic cockroach, a real living cockroach, but one wearing a teeny tiny backpack that has electronic devices that help the researchers control where it travels and how it reports back.
And for people who might be feeling sorry for the bugs at this particular point, wearing these backpacks with wires into their brains and being remote controlled, which sounds like a nightmare, apparently the bugs don't process pain the same way we do. Is that right?
Right. They don't have the same, you know, that was my concern, too. As soon as I started working on the story along with my editorial colleagues, and I was like, wait a minute, what about the poor, you know, poor insects? And they don't have pain sensors the way that we and other mammals do. And so these little bursts of electricity, they're basically just, they interpret them as environmental stimuli, like a bright light, say. The same way they would process a bright light is the same way they process the little electric stimuli that the researchers give them. And they're not like remote controlling them in the sense of just completely controlling the animal. What they're doing right now is showing it to turn left, turn right, go this way. So it's in the basic stages, and they say the animals really, you know, they don't experience the pain or the disorientation that we might worry about. But it could be incredibly valuable for, if you think about everything from, again, like earthquake victims, search and rescue teams made of like teeny tiny cockroaches, to everything from, you know, surveillance, keeping an eye on the bad guys with a hawk moth. That's kind of cool, I have to admit.
So one day we could literally be the fly on the wall.
Don't quit your day job.
Before we move on, I mean, does it work that well, this remote control, that we can actually pilot a moth reliably and not just keep whapping into the light fixture or the wall like an actual moth would?
Well, right now, it is in the early stages. The moth is in the very early stages. And one of the issues is just, even though it's a tiny amount of weight that they add on to the moth with its little backpack, it does mess its flight up right now. So they think in a couple of years, the electronics will be shrunk down enough that they'll be able to just put the little backpack on the moth and send it on its way. But right now, they're actually using balloons, which kind of cuts down on the surreptitious spy angle a little bit. If you see a moth with a balloon, you know. They think in a couple of years, yeah, this is something that they're going to work it out. And, you know, they're really advancing the research very quickly.
And finally, Gemma, you wrote a feature, 20 Things You Didn't Know About Marijuana. I guess it's in the news a lot, still a little controversial, but what did you learn while you were writing this?
Well, you know, the interesting thing, I wanted to write this because there is so much out there now, and it's mostly of a political nature, of a societal nature, and so there's a lot of talk about marijuana, but there's still a lot we don't know. And one of my one of the reasons this really interested me is because late last year, there was this landmark genetic study where they looked at a variety of commercially grown marijuana plants from all different sources, and they looked at them really on a genetic level. And they found out that they actually didn't know a lot about marijuana, either how it originated, what species was what, and it kind of tells you that everyone, you know, makes jokes about it, it's in pop culture a lot, it's now increasingly in politics, the issue of legalization, but we really, there's a lot we don't know about it, so I wanted to explore that issue.
Well, tell us a little bit about the history and prehistory of human cultivation and use of marijuana.
Well, we know for a fact that humans have been cultivating it for at least 6,000 years, and there's some evidence that it may be 12,000 years that we've been cultivating it, which is interesting because that would make it one of our very first crops, which, you know, is kind of curious. For a long time, it was eaten. It was used to weave fibers and other products, but almost from the earliest, the psychoactive nature of it was also remarked upon, and it's in a lot of texts. You know, probably most of us have heard about, you know, the ancient Hindu texts mentioning it as one of five sacred herbs. It's also in the very first medical text from China, but it's also in the Talmud, which is Judaism's key ancient text, and they found evidence of it in some of the big Egyptian tombs, including one of the biggest ones of all, that of the pharaoh Ramses II. So it was like the ancient world was really kind of clued into it and making active use of it as a food, as a textile, and as a psychoactive drug.
What do we know about where it originally came from, and the word itself, too, for that matter?
Yeah, well, actually, the etymology of it is really fascinating because we got the word. You know, a lot of the world refers to it as cannabis, and Americans did, too, until the 19th century. And then we borrowed a Mexican term, and that Mexican term, marijuana, it's spelled a little bit differently, but there is disagreement whether that word originated in China, where parts of the plant are referred to as ma ren and ma hua, and apologies to any native Chinese speakers. I know that was a really bad pronunciation, but you get the idea. But other researchers think there's actually an Arabic origin of the word that may have arrived in Mexico via Moorish Spain. So there's a lot of disagreement about the word itself and about the plant itself. We think it came from Central Asia, but it may have come from South Asia. There's a lot of, you know, we're not really sure. It's a mystery, and they're just trying to figure it out on a genetic level, and
shrouded in
a lot of trouble.
Shrouded in a smoky haze of mystery. Gemma, thanks.
Always great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
That's Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month with some of the most intriguing stories in science.